Can you hear me? Okay, so I'm going to talk about some new results and some old results in proof complexity. And basically the talk is divided into two parts, more or less. The first part will be covering really old, relatively old results that happened before the year 2000, and then I'll talk about some recent results, basically in the last 10 or so years. If you have any questions, just stop me. Okay, because I'm going to cover a lot of material, but I'm not going to do any proof, so it's going to be sort of a high-level summary of what's going on in the field. And again, it's very biased, so there's a lot of other things going on that I won't be talking about. Okay, so first of all, what's a proof system? You probably know this already, but a formal definition is that it's a polynomial time onto function from strings, which you think of as proofs, to encodings of unsatisfiable formulas. And you want it to be onto because you want the proof system to be complete, okay? And you want it to be polynomial time because you want to be able to recognize whether something's a proof of something relatively efficiently. And we say that a proof system S for the set of all unsatisfiable propositional formulas is polynomially bounded if every unsatisfiable formula with a reasonable encoding has a proof of size polynomial in the size of the unsatisfiable formula. Okay, and Cook in the early 70s, together with Reckow, his student, proved that you know, once you have the definition set up, that this is almost immediate, this theorem, that the question of the existence of a polynomially bounded proof system is exactly the same as the question of whether NP equals co-NP. And Cook's program, I'm not sure that you actually ever called this your own program, but it's now referred to as Cook's program, is to try to prove super polynomial lower bounds, develop methods for proving lower bounds for increasingly more powerful proof systems. And I've been hooked sort of on this program since my PhD years in the late 80s. So the nice thing about this program is that you can divide up proofs, you can characterize proof systems in a very clean way based on the strength of the underlying lines in the proof. And so the sort of simplest non-trivial proof system that you probably all know about is resolution. And resolution operates on clauses. So the power of the lines is just what we call depth one formulas, ORs of literals. Okay? And so you start with a set of clauses that's the unsatisfiable formula. And there's only one rule, the resolution rule, and it allows you to derive a new clause from two previous clauses by resolving on a literal X. And the goal is to drive the empty clause. Okay, so you probably all know this. This is a sound and complete proof system, and you measure the proof size by either the sum of the total number of connectives, or you can also measure it to be the number of clauses used. Since the clauses are short of length at most n, where n is the number of variables, we usually just measure size to be the number of clauses. Okay, so resolution is polynomially bounded if every unsatisfiable CNF formula has a polynomial length proof. So it has a proof that involves a derivation using only polynomially many clauses. Okay? And a much more general class of proof systems is called Frege systems. This lumps together pretty much all textbook-style proof systems. lines now, instead of being clauses, lines are arbitrary Boolean formulas over some complete basis. And this is a partial example of a Frege system. I didn't write all the rules and axioms that makes it complete, but just to give you the idea, you have an underlying basis. In this case, it's and, or, and not, and you specify a bunch of axiom schemas and rule schemas, and a proof is just a refutation of an unsatisfiable formula. It's, again, a sequence of formulas where you start with the formula you're trying to refute, and you derive new formulas from previous ones via the rules and the axioms, and you're trying to derive the identically false formula. Okay? And the proof size, again, is basically the sum of the sizes of all the lines. And the size of a line can be taken to be the total number of connectives in the formula. Okay? So you can characterize lots of different proof systems based on the complexity of the underlying line. So resolution is viewed as a depth 1 AC0 formula. So as a depth 1, is a proof system where all the underlying lines are depth 1 AC0 formulas. Okay, AC0 is a collection, is the Boolean circuit class over the unbounded fan-in and or a not basis. And AC0 refers to the fact that you're only allowed to have a constant number of levels, so that when you write it as a circuit or a formula, the depth is constant. Okay. So the way I defined a Frege system, it was over the fan in, the or and were fan in 2, and here I'm talking about fan in, arbitrary unbounded fan in. There's different ways to deal with this. You can either change the rules of the proof system to deal with unbounded fan in, or you can just define the depth of a formula to be the number of alternations of the connectives. Okay, so if you see 2 ors in a row, you just count that as 1. So anyways, you get a nice characterization of pretty much most of the natural proof systems that you might be interested in, and lots of other ones that you might not think are natural, but they're inspired by classes in circuit complexity. So there's a family AC0 Frege. This is a restriction of Frege proofs where you don't allow any formulas, where you only allow formulas that are AC0 formulas, bounded depth formulas. And Frege systems, we said before, you're allowed arbitrary formulas. And extended Frege is a generalization of a Frege system where you have an extra axiom schema, and it essentially allows the lines to be arbitrary Boolean circuits. Okay? And the proof size is always measured to be the sum of the sizes of all the lines in the proof. And you can see that as the proof systems get stronger, the reason they get stronger, or we think they get stronger, is that the expressive power of the lines gets bigger and bigger. So you can say more things more efficiently. Okay? So there's this hierarchy of proof systems, and it's growing much more quickly. It's sort of like the proof system zoo, like the complexity zoo. It's growing really fast, and we really can't say much, so it just keeps growing. We'd like to prove some lower bounds for more of these proof systems and basically understand them much better than we currently do. But the hierarchy indicates the relative complexity of one proof system versus another. So a proof system would be higher than another one if any proof in this lower proof system can be polynomially simulated by a proof in the upper one. Okay. Polynomially simulated meaning that if you have a proof down here, you have a proof up here of the same formula that's of size no more than polynomial in this size. Okay. A lot of these you might not have heard of, but the important ones are for today is resolution that I've talked about already, Frege systems, extended Frege, AC0 Frege. Those are some of the ones I'll be focusing on. They're some of the main ones. And at some point I'll talk a little bit about a different type of proof system that operates with linear inequalities. And examples of those are cutting planes. LS stands for Lovaas-Shriver. So I'll be talking about those a little bit later. And there's also algebraic proof systems where you manipulate algebraic formulas. And these on the right side are algebraic proof systems. I won't be talking about those today. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit about some of the lower bounds. There are a few achievements, some very nice lower bounds that's known, and basically what I would consider to be 3 main methods. And I'll just briefly tell you about them, and then I'll move on to some newer results. So the lower bound methods, the way I've characterized them is there's the width-space method, interpolation method, and then what I'll call I-ties method. And all the lower bounds that I'll show you or that I'll talk about for different proof systems, the hard formula, you can take it to be basically the same formula all the time, which is the propositional pigeonhole principle. And this is sort of a negative because the pigeonhole principle isn't really very hard. So the fact that this is the strongest, the fact that we can prove all of our lower bounds with this principle, already shows the limitations of the techniques. So what's the pigeonhole principle? You have variables Pij that tell you whether pigeon I gets mapped to hole J, and you have a parameter N, where N is the number of holes, and you always have more pigeons than holes. So in this example, we have 10 pigeons. You might not be able to see the 10th one, but it's together with the first one. And so you have 10 pigeons and you have 9 holes, and the principle states that if every pigeon, so these clauses say that every pigeon goes to a hole, so pigeon 1 goes to one of the 9 holes, and you have this for every pigeon I. Those are called the pigeon clauses, and then the hole clauses tell you that no 2 pigeons can sit in the same hole. Okay, so this is the unsatisfiable version of the formula, and it's saying that there is a 1-to-1 onto map from N plus 1 pigeons to N holes. Okay. And the size of the formula is a function of n, is roughly n to the third, because the number of whole clauses is roughly n to the third, because you have every pair of pigeons in every whole, you have a pigeon, you have a whole clause. Okay, so probably the first really substantial, there was lower bounds before this one, but this was the first one that generated what I would consider to be a lot of excitement and really started people really thinking hard about lower bounds and proof complexity, was Armin Haken's lower bound for resolution for the pigeonhole principle. And basically, his proof, now that we look at it in retrospect, he more or less, the moral is that you shouldn't be really looking at the size, you should be looking at the width. And width is the same as what Albert defined width to be in his talk. So the width of a clause is the number of variables in the clause. Okay? And the width of a refutation, therefore, is just the maximum width of all the clauses in the proof. The width of a formula, now you look over all refutations and you look for the minimal width proof. Okay? And basically what his argument did was to reduce the size bound question to a width bound question. Okay? So he proved a little bit indirectly that if you can prove width lower bounds, so if you can prove that any proof of the pigeonhole principle in resolution requires a large width clause, then it follows from that that any proof of the pigeonhole principle requires exponential size. And I didn't say what large is, but large should be something like n to the epsilon. The bigger large is, the bigger your bound will be, the bigger your size bound will be. And so this method was used to prove lower bounds after resolution. It was also used to prove other lower bounds for some other proof systems as well. Okay, so there's two steps to the argument. The first step is to actually do the reduction to show that if you have a I don't have a slide for the first part. So the first part of the reduction shows that that you can reduce to width, and then the second part is to get a lower bound for width. I'm not going to really go through this proof. It's a very nice proof. There's been lots of reproofs of it, but the basic idea to reduce to width, the width bound, is either to hit the proof with the restriction. That means you set some of the variables to zero and some of the variables to one in a very careful way, so that after you apply the restriction to the whole proof, what you're left with is still a proof of the pigeonhole principle on fewer pigeons and fewer holes, but now where the proof is narrow. Okay, or you can apply a general size-width trade-off that was proven by Elie Bensoussain and Avi Vigdorsson. So what you should take away from this is that for resolution, all you need to do is prove a width bound. And it's essential to prove a width bound, because if all of your clauses in the proof are small, then the proof has to be small. So if all of your clauses have size, say, log n or less, the total number of such clauses is polynomial in n, so that means the proof is going to be small. So you have to prove a width bound to get a size bound, in this theorem saying that it's enough to just prove the width bound. Okay? And I think I credit Alistair Urquhart with really crystallizing how you get a width bound and the essence behind getting a width bound, and it's really related to expansion of the underlying formula. This isn't how Armin Haken originally proved it. His argument was more complicated. You walked in just at the right time. That's Alistair Urquhart. It seems like we planned that. So the idea behind a width bound at a very high level is you have this CNF formula. In the case of the pigeonhole principle, obviously, it's the pigeonhole principle, but forget about the pigeonhole principle for now. You have an arbitrary CNF formula. You can make a bipartite graph that describes the structure of the formula, where you label the left side, the vertices on the left of the graph, with clauses, one node for every clause, and on the right side with all of the variables. And you put an edge between a clause node and a variable node if that variable occurs in the clause. Okay, so you get a bipartite graph in a natural way. And this graph is expanding if, for every subset of nodes on the left or every small subset of clauses, if you look at the neighborhood set on the right, which is all the variables in total that are contained in that subset of clauses, if that's a big set relative to the subset on the left, okay, then the graph's called expanding. And the claim that Alistair proved very you know, like I said, he sort of crystallized this idea, is that if you have a formula F that's minimally unsatisfiable, in other words, you can't take away any of the clauses and still have it be unsatisfiable, then if the graph has large expansion, any resolution proof of it will have large, will require large width. And the idea behind it is really simple. It's simple relative to previous arguments, but I'll just give you a one-liner for why it's true. So since the formula is minimally unsatisfiable, it eventually has to use all of the initial clauses. So you find the first place in the proof, going from the initial clauses down to the empty clause, you find a first place in the proof where you're using, say, half of the initial clauses, maybe a little less than half, maybe n over 4 of the initial clauses. Okay? And now you look at that clause that was derived from them. Now the point is that if the graph has big expansion, then it also has big boundary expansion. Boundary expansion are the variables that occur in exactly one of those clauses. Okay? And all of the variables that are in the boundary of this set of clauses, they couldn't have been resolved on because there's only one copy of them, so they have to sit along for the ride. So that means this clause that you derived from n over 4 previous ones has to be wide. It has to have all these boundary variables in it. Okay? And that's the idea. Okay, so that's basically the width method. the width method is very nice when it works. It doesn't work for all sorts of interesting proof systems, obviously. And so then another method was developed that's called the feasible interpolation method, and this is the same interpolation as Craig's interpolation, but it might look a little different the way I'm going to talk about it. So in this method, we're actually going to just reduce directly the question of getting a lower bound for certain proof systems to a circuit lower bound, to a monotone circuit lower bound. Okay. So we're just going to use a reduction, and in the end, the proof is going to use the known lower bounds for monotone circuits. So I should say to start with that all of these lower bounds that I'm talking about, they work for particular proof systems and they work for particular formulas, obviously. And this method works for formulas that are of this special type, F equals A, P, Q, N, B, P, R. So these are interpolant type statements. So you have a CNF formula A that has variables, a vector of variables P and a vector of variables Q, and another CNF formula B that has a vector of variables P and R. The shared variables are the P variables, and then the private ones are Q and R. And there's a search problem associated with this interpolant formula, which is given an assignment to the shared variables, determine whether A is unsatisfiable or B is unsatisfiable. So assuming that the original formula is unsatisfiable, one of the two has to be unsatisfiable. They might both be. Okay, and that's called the interpolant problem associated with this statement. And sometimes it can help to know that if you have a short proof of this interpolant statement in the first place in a relatively weak proof system, it can be very helpful to solve, it can help you to solve the interpolant problem. So we'll say that a proof system admits feasible interpolation or monotone feasible interpolation if anytime you have a short refutation of A and B, you also have a small circuit for computing the interpolant function. Okay, so if I give you a short proof of A and B in, say, resolution has feasible interpolation property. If by looking at that proof, there's an algorithm that can look at that proof and come up with a small circuit for deciding whether A is false or B is false on a given input to the shared variables. Okay. And it turns out that resolution has feasible interpolation, so does cutting planes. That's a proof system where the lines are linear inequalities. And because these proof systems have feasible interpolation, using this reduction, you can show that this property of feasible interpolation immediately implies superpolynomial lower bounds. Okay? And so that's the only way we currently know that's the only method we have so far of getting lower bounds for cutting planes. And it's also a new way to get lower bounds for resolution. So we have two methods for resolution. So feasible interpolation is very nice from the lower bound point of view. If a proof system has it, it means we immediately get lower bounds. And there's a converse, which is very interesting. If a proof system doesn't have feasible interpolation, then it turns out that S is not, the proof system S is not automatizable. And automatizable is a notion that means if a proof system is automatizable, it means there's an algorithm that can find short proofs whenever they exist. Okay, so it's a search problem associated with the proof system. So feasible interpolation ends up being a really nice property because if a system has feasible interpolation, you get lower bounds. If it doesn't have feasible interpolation, you know that the search problem associated with the proof system is hard. Okay, so that's the second main method that was discovered in the 90s. And again, it was used to prove lower bounds for cutting planes, resolution, and a few other systems. It has a nice application by Razborov. It's basically you can apply the method to show that a particular formulation of the statement that P doesn't equal NP, that doesn't have resolution, short resolution proofs. So using the interpolation method applied to resolution, you can prove a meta-mathematical result that a certain formulation of P not equal NP can't be proven in resolution. Okay, the last method I'm going to basically tell you nothing about because it would take me the whole day to describe this method. And even if I had a day, I'm not sure that I would be able to do a good job. But this is a really beautiful result by Itai, and it was extended by several authors. And it's a method that's used to prove lower bounds for AC0 Frege proofs. And it was discovered in 88. So let me just tell you one thing about this proof, which is that this proof uses non-standard model theory in a very essential way. And I think it's very important to the essence of this proof. And I think if we understood how to do this better, we would, this is an avenue to getting much stronger results that I don't think anybody's figured out how to do. It also uses some heavy-duty combinatorial machinery. He develops a switching lemma that's specific for the pigeonhole principle. So there's some combinatorics involved. But I think the new insight that sort of wasn't already around in other guises is the strong use of non-standard model theory and forcing to get this result to go through. One other area of lower bounds that I wanted to briefly mention is space complexity. So far I've been talking about size complexity, trying to prove lower bounds on the length of a proof for stronger and stronger proof systems. In 98, Armin Haken, at a meeting here at the Fields, he asked the question about why don't we look at space complexity instead of just time complexity. And so this area has been quite active since 1998. Esteban and Torian defined the space complexity of a resolution proof. It's a very natural definition. The idea is that you have this unsatisfiable formula that you start with. You're trying to prove it's unsatisfiable. You can add those clauses to working memory anytime you want. And to derive a new clause, you have to have the two previous ones already in working memory. Okay, and again, you're trying to derive the empty clause, but what you're measuring now is not the length of the proof. You're measuring how much working memory you need, how many clauses you need to have in memory at one time in order to get the contradiction. Okay, so if you look at a particular proof, it has to do with the pebbling number of that proof, or sort of, the pebbling number of the proof, how complicated the graph of the proof is. and this is a very nice area that I haven't had too much to do with except to follow the results. There's very nice lower bounds on space. Space was also extended to other proof systems, and some results are known there. And there's some really dramatic time-space trade-offs that are known by Ben Sassoon and Nordstrom and others, showing that there's examples of formulas that that have short proofs, but the space will be huge, n is the biggest it ever has to be. But if you try to shrink the space just a little bit, the time will blow up to exponential. Okay, so there's all sorts of really nice trade-offs known. And this is relevant for theorem proving, because in practical theorem provers, you really run out of space quite quickly, and that's a big problem. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to talk about some recent results. And I have this divided up into four areas. I'm really going to spend most of the time on the first two. The C and D are really kind of ongoing things that I think are new areas that There's many more open questions than answers so far, so I'm going to focus mostly on the first two. These recent results are not, so I would say that since about 2000, there haven't been any major successes in proving new lower bounds for stronger proof systems. We're pretty stuck right now, so if anybody has any ideas, please write a paper. So what I'm going to talk about now are these newer areas. They're sort of applications of proof theoretic methods to other areas. Okay, and the first area is using proof complexity to prove lower bounds and inapproximability results in concrete computational models. Okay, so the idea here is very natural. If you have a proof system such as Resolution or Frege, it gives rise to a restricted class of natural algorithms for solving satisfiability. Okay, and what is that class of algorithms? It's all the algorithms where you can you can formalize the correctness proof of that algorithm within the proof system. So if you prove exponential or superpolynomial lower bounds for that proof system, you're essentially ruling out that whole class of algorithms for solving SAT in polynomial time. Okay. And if you look closer, sometimes you can get even more interesting connections. So I'm going to describe a couple of examples of this today. So the first example is a little bit old, but it's important. It's looking at SAT algorithms from the lens of resolution. And we'll talk about that first. But let me just say one thing first. This is point number three. So extended Frege, there's stronger and stronger proof systems. You don't have to stop at extended Frege. You can think of Zermelo-Frankel set theory, if you want, as a proof system for propositional logic. Okay, but the only we don't know of any examples of formulas that don't have small extended Frege proofs. Okay, so most of the time people stop at extended Frege because we don't have any idea if this hierarchy of proof systems gets stronger and stronger, or if extended Frege is the strongest one. We don't really understand at all. If you get more and more power as you go up. It's different in complexity theory. There we do know that if you add more and more time, you get more and more functions. In this case, we don't know that. but let me just point out that pretty much all the polynomial time algorithms that we know of, they're formalizable in extended Frege. So if you could prove the lower bounds for extended Frege, you wouldn't be proving NP doesn't equal co-NP, but you'd be basically ruling out pretty much every algorithmic approach that we know of. Okay, so let me start with SAT algorithms and DPLL. So DPLL is this common procedure, Davis, Putnam, Logman? Anyways, DPLL. So DPLL is a particular type of resolution. It's a resolution-based algorithm for solving SAT. And really, it's simple to describe. You just create a decision tree. So you start with your unsatisfiable formula. You make a decision tree. You query a variable. You branch on the variable being true and false. You look at your formula under that simplification. As soon as the formula becomes identically false, you truncate that path, and you backtrack, and you move on. Okay, so it's a backtracking algorithm. And there's all sorts of really interesting extensions of DPLL using heuristics such as clause learning, watched literals, and so on that have made this procedure incredibly efficient. I'm sure you all know much more about this than I do. So in all of these extensions of DPLL, you still stay within the realm of resolution-based algorithms. So proving lower bounds for resolution, Armin Haken's result, basically tells you that in the worst case, none of these algorithms are going to be successful in polynomial time. Okay, but you can sometimes say more, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So I want to look at the typical distribution of random instances of K-CNF formulas. So you have a parameter M, you pick M clauses at random, each of size K. Typical example is a random, you can't hear me? Oh. Typical example is random 3-CNF formula. You pick random clauses, each of size 3, and there's a threshold value where if you pick more than that many clauses, almost certainly the formula is unsatisfiable, and less than that many clauses, almost certainly the formula is satisfiable. And for k equals 3, the threshold is at 3 point something. Okay, now like I said before, we know it's been proven by for this distribution of instances, Kratal and Samaredi actually proved that above the threshold, just a little bit above the threshold, any resolution proof of those formulas, which are almost certainly unsatisfiable, any resolution proof is going to be exponential size. Okay, so we know in the unsatisfiable region that resolution does badly. But the more interesting question is what happens on satisfiable instances, because DPLL, after all, is trying to find satisfying assignments in all of the implementations. If it doesn't find an assignment after a certain amount of time, it just aborts. It's an incomplete method, and people deal with that. So you don't really care about the unsatisfiable ones from a practical point of view. You care about the other side of the threshold. And so there was a paper by Beam, Akleoptis, and Malloy, I think from 2004, and they actually showed that you can use resolution lower bounds to even prove, to even say something about formulas that are satisfiable and DPLL-style executions on these formulas. And the intuition is that if you start with a random formula just below the threshold, this yellow here is a picture of the decision tree that we're going to create, and we're going to backtrack on it. So you pick a variable and you branch on it, and you have to make some assumptions about exactly how you're picking the variable, because since there's no complexity involved in this analysis, I could just look at the formula, decide exactly what's going on, and pick exactly the right variables. So you have to make some assumptions about the heuristics for how you're making the decision tree. Okay? So anyways, you pick a variable according to some heuristic, and for most reasonable heuristics, what you're going to end up with at some point is a residual formula under the restriction where you have a mix of two clauses and three clauses. So it's still going to be a random formula, but now it's going to have two and three clauses in it. And what does the procedure do? It just goes down until, you know, it follows the path until it determines that it's unsatisfiable, in which case it backtracks, or it finds a satisfying assignment, in which case it's done. And what's going to happen, and they prove this, is that what's very likely to happen is that you're going to hit this red node here where you have an unsatisfiable mixed instance. And not only is it unsatisfiable, but resolution is going to take exponential time to figure that out. Okay? So by the time you get to satisfaction here, it'll be exponential time away. So you're not really ever going to be satisfied. This is from a paper by Kvatal and Reed that was called Mick Gets His, The Odds Are on His Side, or something like that. Okay, so it's a really nice application of how to say something about practical algorithms for solving SAT. And this is a technical statement of their theorem, which basically is along the lines of if you take a random formula just below the threshold and you look at certain natural heuristics for running DPLL, it'll take exponential time to solve. Okay. So the second example is really a huge area, and I'm not going to have time to say much about it, but it's a huge developing area that connects it studies linear programming SDP algorithms for solving not just SAT, but lots of NP hard optimization problems, NP complete optimization problems, and an associated family of proof systems that I'll lump together and call matrix cut systems. Okay, matrix cut systems for now, just think of them as proof systems that operate with linear inequalities. So this is a picture of a whole bunch of NP hard optimization problems, and now I'm switching gears a little bit, and I'm not just talking about solving them exactly, but I want all of these problems are NP hard, so we're just going to assume they can't be solved exactly, but the question is how well can you approximate them? Again, this is a huge area of complexity theory, and there's all sorts of really beautiful results known about the inapproximability of these problems. But what I want to talk about now is slightly different. I want to study a large class of algorithms for solving these problems, which are algorithms that are based on relaxations of linear programming and semi-definite programming programs. So, simple example, we start with Max3SAT. So Max3SAT, you're given, again, a CNF formula. Now, instead of determining whether it's satisfiable or not, we want to come up with an assignment that satisfies the maximal number of clauses as possible. Okay, this problem is well known to be hard, NP-hard, and it's also hard to approximate in the very strongest sense. So Hosted proved I just recently got, the Girdle Prize for this paper. he proved a very tight result that there's no polynomial time. You can't do better than a 7/8 approximation unless P equals NP. Okay? And this is the best possible, because if you take any formula at all and you pick a random assignment to the variables, you're going to, every clause is going to be satisfied with probability, whatever it is. 7/8. So the expected number of clauses that you'll satisfy is 7/8. Okay, so there's a trivial randomized upper bound. You can turn that into a deterministic upper bound, and this is saying you can't do better than that unless P equals NP. But let's say instead we wanted to study particular family of programs, linear programs, say, for solving this problem, and we don't want a conditional result. We want to prove unconditionally that no linear programming approach, relaxation of a linear program, can do better than this. Okay, under no assumptions. So that's the goal. So we can formulate, this is probably the most natural linear program for that problem. So you have one linear inequality corresponding to every clause, and y1 is the variable that's the value of the clause under the assignment to the variables for that clause. And, you know, this is saying that the value has to be at least y1, and so on. And this is saying that all the variables sit between 0 and 1. for the integer program, you would say that they're exactly 0 or 1, but this is the relaxation. Okay? And what are you trying to maximize? You're trying to maximize the sum of the yi's. You're trying to maximize the number of clauses that are true. Okay? So the integrality gap, in general, of a linear program is the optimum of the relaxed version divided by the optimum over all the integer points. Okay? And the integrality gap for a linear program is typically viewed to be the right measure of how well any algorithm based on this linear program, based on the relaxation of this linear program, how well it can approximate the problem. Okay? So it's known that for this linear program that I just showed you for max 3 sat, that the integrality gap is 8/7. Okay? So it matches what Hosted did. So... And the question is, so that's just one linear program. You analyze that linear program, you prove the integrality gap. But what about other linear programs? And maybe that was a dumb one. Maybe we should have added a lot more constraints. Maybe we should have added triangle inequalities or who knows what. And maybe with a better polynomial size linear program or even an exponential size implicit linear program, maybe we could solve it much better than this 8/7. So that's what we'd like to do, rule out all polynomial time linear programming relaxations, or even more generally, would like to rule out all SDP-based ones. And if you like pictures, here's a picture of what's going on. So this is a gray area that defines all the linear solutions to the original instance of max 3 sat. You can't see it, can you? I guess you can see it a little bit. And then you define your particular linear program, which is the one I showed you, and that defines a polytope that's bigger, possibly bigger than the original one because it has other points in it. And the integrality gap is the ratio of the best integer solution versus the best non-integer solution. And in this picture, the objective is increasing as you go this way. Okay? So what I'm trying to say is this is the best integer solution, this is the best non-integer solution, so there's a difference there. Okay? But you can add more inequalities that are sound, in other words, they preserve all the integer solutions, you can add them to the original linear program, thereby ruling out some of the non-integral points, and then the program will be better, it'll be tighter, it'll have a smaller integrality gap, and you could imagine continuing to do this until you eventually get to the integral hall. Okay? So these matrix cut systems are various, I think of them as proof systems. They're rule-based systems that allow you to start with a bunch of linear inequalities, derive new ones from previous ones in a sound manner, meaning that you preserve all the integer solutions. Okay? And there's lots of them. The Kvatsal-Gomery cutting planes was probably the original one. And there's the Shirali-Adams, Lovaas-Shriver, Lasserre, there's a whole bunch of them. all of them except for cutting planes have the property that... So you think of these systems as operating in rounds. So you start with the original inequalities. You apply the rules to derive all possible inequalities that you could get in one round. This gives you, remember the picture of the polytope, you have the polytope from the original linear inequalities. You do one round and you get a shrunken polytope, and you keep doing this in rounds. And all of these proof systems have the property that if you do it n times, or n is the number of variables, you will get to the integral Hall. And furthermore, you can actually, in polynomial time, you can solve the relaxed problem in time n to the r for the rth round polytope. Okay? So that's why people are so interested in them. They're actually somewhat practical to use from a algorithmic point of view. And there's a large body of work in the last 10 years proving integrality gaps for various problems in many of these proof systems. And there's close connections to the unique gains conjecture. There's some very deep results in this area. Again, I'm just scratching at the surface of this area, but I just wanted to point out that proof complexity methods have been used rather extensively in proving some of these integrality gaps. And I'm just mentioning a few of them here. The WIDS expansion method that I talked about for resolution is actually used pretty directly to prove lower bounds for integrality gaps for various matrix cut systems, such as cutting planes, LS plus, Lasserre, and so on. And another paper with Nathan Segerlin and myself from a few years ago, we show using proof complexity methods that you can translate a rank bound to a size bound. So this is sort of like what Armin Haken did when he shows that if you have a width bound, you get a size bound. This is a sort of analogous result in the world of matrix cut systems. I think I won't mention the last result. So that's a big area, and since you are talking about proof systems for solving approximation problems, obviously, methods of proving lower bounds and proof complexity have been very relevant in some of the work. There's some results that have nothing to do with proof complexity. The problems are very hard, but there's a very nice interplay between the two areas. So a second area that I wanted to mention has to do with, totally different than anything I've talked about before, has to do with model checking, games, and automatizability. I mentioned automatizability before. So a proof system S is automatizable if there's an algorithm such that for every unsatisfiable formula F, the algorithm returns a short refutation of F. And short should mean that it returns a refutation of F, and the runtime of the algorithm, so the time it takes to find the refutation, should be polynomial in the size of the shortest refutation. Okay? So in other words, if a proof system is automatizable, then even though it might not have short proofs for everything, whenever it does, you can find them. Okay? And it's been an open problem for a while now, which proof systems are automatizable and which aren't. And if a proof system is automatizable, it's good and bad news. It's good news in that means that you can develop theorem-proving algorithms based on that proof system, and they're going to be as good as the proof system. But again, the main point is that it's an open problem whether very low-depth Frege systems are automatizable. Okay? It's an open problem that people have actively been working on, and we still really, I would say we don't know the answer. We have no clue whether the answer is yes or no. And what I want to tell you about today is a result that started with a paper by Albert Etzerius and Maneva, showing a strong connection between the question of the complexity of various stochastic and other games and the automatizability question in proof complexity. So let me just, probably you all know more, some of you probably know a lot about these games more than me, but I'll tell you about a few of these games and then I'll state the result. So parity games is it's a game that you play on a directed graph, and you have two players, the odd player, who is green, and the odd player is blue, and the even player is green. And the nodes of the graph have weights, and they start at some start vertex v0, and they take turns. So if I'm in a green vertex, the green player gets to make the move. At a blue vertex, the blue player gets to make the move. It's an infinite game, so they continue forever. And the green player wins if a path pi, an infinite path pi, is a play of the game, starting from some vertex v0. And this path is a win for player 0 if, when you look at the numbers associated with the path, so so every node has a number associated with it. The highest number on the path that's repeated infinitely often is even. Okay? And otherwise, if the highest number repeated infinitely often is odd, then the other guy wins. Okay? So that's what a parity game is, and that's the definition of a win for a path. And the problem is, given a graph and a vertex V0, does player 0 have a winning strategy starting from that point? And this is a fascinating problem. It's in NP intersect co-NP. There's no exponential time algorithm. There's no polynomial time algorithm for it. Best algorithm is exponential. It's a very simple problem to state, and the complexity is really completely unresolved. I think most people probably think it's in P, that I'm not... I haven't done a formal poll, but that's my guess as to what people think. It's strongly connected to model checking. So the mu calculus is an expressive temporal logic, and the model checking problem for the mu calculus is equivalent to the problem I just defined on parity games. Another game that's even more powerful that generalizes parity games along with many other games is called a simple stochastic game. This is a stochastic game. The other game wasn't. Again, you have a graph. You have two players. You have a max player. That's the pink guy. And you have a blue player. That's the red person, the red one. And you have, oh, sorry. No, the min player is green. I'm not good with colors. So the min player is green. The max player is red. And you have a third type of node, which is a random node. And you have two sinks, a zero sink and a one sink. And again, the game is played by starting at some initial vertex V0. Whenever you're at a max node, the max player gets to pick which way to go. At a min node, the min player gets to pick. And at a random node, just assume for now that this graph has the property that there's always two edges coming out of every node. So for a random node, 50-50, they go to one edge versus the other. Okay? And the question associated with a particular game is, given this graph G and given a start vertex V0, does the max player have a strategy? So a strategy means it's a memoryless strategy. A strategy with the strategy is for every max vertex, you pick one of the edges that you're always going to take. Okay? And a min strategy is the same. The min node, you pick a direction to go. So given G and a vertex V0, does max have a strategy, since it's for all min strategies, they're always going to reach the one sink with probability at least a half. Okay, so can they play the game starting with V0 in a way so that max player is always guaranteed to get to the one sink with probability at least a half? Okay, it's a well-defined game. The answer is either yes or no. And you can assume that this game is always eventually terminating so that the game eventually gets to zero or one sink so that this is defined. Okay, so that's the problem. And... Condon defined this problem in 92, and there's been many, many papers on it since then. Again, it's a fascinating problem. It's turns out to be equivalent to essentially all important two-player zero-sum perfect information stochastic games. There's a list of some that it's equivalent to, and Zwick proved that it's stronger than, or that it's at least as strong as these other non-stochastic games that are of great interest, such as parity games and mean payoff games. Like I said before, the complexity of all of these problems is unresolved. They're all in NP intersect co-NP. It's not too hard to see. Therefore, they're highly unlikely to be NP complete. Best known algorithms for any of them is exponential. And the other really interesting thing about them is that they're contained in these total search classes, PLS, that stands for polynomial local search, and PPAD. So PPAD is the class that Nash equilibria is complete for. Okay, so they're contained in both of these classes, which makes them very interesting. So there doesn't seem like they're going to be complete for any obvious natural class that we know of because they're in both of them. Okay. So the theorem that I was referring to by Albert Atzarius and Elisa Minerva shows that if depth 2 AC0 Frege is automatizable, then mean payoff games is in P. And they have a similar result about feasible interpolation, but you have to go up to depth 3. And with my student Lei Huang, we showed recently that similar thing is true for simple stochastic games. So if AC0 Frege has feasible interpolation, AC0 2 Frege plus something I'll call IGOP, has feasible interpolation, then simple stochastic gains are in P. And the simpler statement is the second one. If AC03 Frege is automatizable or has feasible interpolation, then simple stochastic gains is in P. Okay. And IGOP is a very natural principle, stands for the integer graph order principle. I won't say too much about it except to say that it's an interesting question whether IGOP has a depth to Frege proof. And it seems possible that one can get some understanding of the relative complexity of mean payoff games versus simple stochastic games by understanding the complexity of IGOP. Okay, so this slide is, so should you care about this result? The naysayer might say, all right, so big deal, if pigs can fly, then anything can happen. So maybe low-depth Frege is not automatizable, in which case, so what? You didn't do anything. So I don't know the answer. To be honest, I really don't know if low-depth Frege is automatizable or not. If I had to bet, I would bet that pigs can fly, unfortunately, but I really don't know. We do know that Frege in general is not automatizable under crypto assumptions. We also know that that result can be scaled down to depth 4 Frege under a very strong crypto assumption, but it doesn't scale down at all below depth 4. So for depth 3 Frege, depth 2 Frege, there's nothing known. And we also know that depth 1 Frege, which is resolution, is somewhat automatizable. So you can find proofs relatively efficiently. Do you have a question? No. So, it's open, and it's really interesting, I think. I only have 1 minute left, so I'll just say one word about the last two. So this is more or less a plug for what I think is an interesting direction for people to work on. In circuit complexity and complexity theory, there's been lots of amazing results in the last 10 years, maybe even 20 years, giving upper bounds. Not upper bounds like algorithms, but upper bounds that are good for complexity theory. Upper bounds that imply lower bounds. And I could list about 10 of them, but I just listed two. And the one that's probably the most famous is Ryan Williams' recent proof that ACC is not in annexed. ACC is the circuit class I think somebody was talking about yesterday, of bounded depth circuits with, you can have arbitrary mod gates like mod 6 gates. And he proved this result, and the way he proved it was actually to come up with a non-trivial satisfiability algorithm for ACC circuits. So it's an upper bound. He actually gets an algorithm that's non-trivial. In other words, it's not a 2 to the n algorithm for solving circuit sat on ACC circuits. And using that upper bound, he gets the result. Okay, so it's a great example of this area that a lot of people have been really interested in lately, which is to show that upper bounds give lower bounds. And another way to sort of do this is instead of an upper bound immediately giving a lower bound, you can give a normal form theorem, which might not completely imply the lower bound, but it'll at least make the lower bound problem a lot easier. And again, in circuit complexity, there's a ton of these results. Results that take a circuit class and say, look, it's the same, like, for example, Allender has this result that many people don't know about, which looks at bounded depth circuits with mod 2 gates, or mod P gates in general, and he proves that quasi-polynomial size fixed depth AC02 circuits are equivalent to quasi-polynomial size depth 4 AC02 circuits. So this is what I call a normal form theorem. It's saying, look, you can just stop it at depth 4 if you're trying to prove quasi-polynomial size lower bounds. And so that's a normal form theorem. It makes the lower bound job much easier. You only have to prove lower bounds up to depth 4. And again, there's lots of really nice results along those lines. And in proof complexity, there's almost no results that I know of like this. And I really don't know why, if people haven't tried or what. But I think this is a really interesting thing to study, whether we can show similar, that some kind of surprising, but not too surprising, upper bounds give lower bounds. And one modest result along these lines is with Yuval Filmus and Rahul Santhanam, and we prove a sort of type of normal form theorem by showing that any polynomials, so if you look at polynomial-sized Frege proofs, anything you can prove with a polynomial-sized Frege proof, you can prove with a sub-exponential size AC0 Frege proof. Okay, so that means if you can prove truly exponential lower bounds for AC0 Frege, you get super polynomial Frege lower bounds. And the only other area that I wanted to, now I have minus 1 minute, a new area in proof complexity that I think has also been a very interesting area is to study parameterized proof complexity. This was initiated by Danchev, Martin, and Sider in 2007. And again, the idea is to scale everything down to the parameterized world, study proof systems with respect to parameterized problems. And again, you can ask all sorts of questions there. And you could develop an analog of Cook's program for the fixed parameter hierarchy, which is to try to prove stronger and stronger lower bounds for the fixed parameter analogs of these proof systems. Done. Thank you.